let there be light.
Oh, well, I tried.
Okay, your lineup for the time you're taking is a little bit different than we often have, so I would like to go through it with you to be sure that we're all on the same page and that what we have between the marshal and me and you all are all the same. 25 minutes by Attorney McLeod, 20 minutes by Attorney
Level,
thank you very much. With a name like Rogensack, you would think I could pronounce everything, but I invariably can't. Okay. And then 10 minutes by Keenan. All right, very good. And then back to you, Attorney McLeod, for 5 minutes in rebuttal. Very good. Are you all prepared to proceed?
We are.
Okay, then we'll call our first case for the day, City Deck Landing LLC versus Circuit Court for Brown County. Please begin.
May it please the court, my name is Eric McLeod, along with my colleague Joe Dietrich. I represent the petitioner City Deck Landing LLC in this case. As the court is well aware, the judiciary is one of three branches of government. Unlike the legislative and executive branches, the courts only have authority to act, to exercise their judicial power, when disputes are properly brought before them. The circuit court in this case improperly exercised its judicial power by issuing an order staying a separate arbitration proceeding involving a legal dispute that was not properly before the court. Arbitration is fundamentally a contractual arrangement. It's a contractual arrangement in which parties agree to resolve their disputes privately, pursuant to agreed-upon rules and without the involvement of the judiciary. The confusion in this case would appear to arise from the fact that arbitration, like court proceedings, involves dispute resolution. The proceedings and the agreed-upon procedures are usually court-like in their nature. However, the fact that arbitration involves the resolution of disputes does not subject it to the court's jurisdiction any more than any other private activity.
Counsel, do you acknowledge that the court had jurisdiction over City Deck and SMET?
It had personal jurisdiction over those two parties as it relates to the matter presented to the circuit court, which was the insurance coverage question.
Right. So now, is it fair to characterize, and please feel free to tell me if I'm wrong on this, is it fair to characterize your complaint as the court having acted in excess of its jurisdiction by directing the affairs of parties that were not before the court?
That is part of our argument, Your Honor, but there's a more fundamental problem with the circuit court's stay order, and that is that it exceeds the authority of the court to act in the first instance. There was no matter before the court that involved the construction dispute.
Involved the construction of what?
The construction dispute. And let me explain what I mean by that, Justice Bradley. The arbitration concerns a construction dispute between my client, City Deck Landing, SMET Construction, and a number of subcontractors. That dispute was the subject of various construction contracts, all of which provided for arbitration. The only issue that was presented to the Brown County Circuit Court in this case concerned Society Insurance's coverage obligation, whether it had an obligation to provide coverage for one of the subcontractors, GB Builders, and then also to SMET, the general contractor, and to us for the construction defects that we're alleging in the arbitration. At no time has the underlying construction dispute been presented to the circuit court for its consideration. It couldn't be because it's the subject of a private arbitration proceeding. And the main objection that we have to the court's stay order is that it reached a matter that was not properly before it. It's not a matter of necessarily, although there are related issues we can discuss this morning about personal jurisdiction. It's not fundamentally a problem of personal jurisdiction, nor even subject matter jurisdiction, which is, as the court is aware, very broad within the circuit court. The circuit courts have broad general subject matter jurisdiction. In this case, the jurisdictional defect, is the fact that the matter over which the circuit court purported to exercise its authority. The matter was not before the court.
So let's change it up just a little bit, and let's say that instead of entering a stay order, and I think it was clear that this was a stay order, let's say instead the court enjoined CityDeck and SMET from further participation in the arbitration until the declaratory judgment action was completed. Would that have been in excess of the court's jurisdiction?
I believe it would be for reasons different than the underlying objection that I've just articulated.
What would the reasons be then?
Well, the reasons would be, first and foremost, that the circuit court didn't do that in this case, did not evaluate the motion in the sense of what are the standards for entering an injunction against conduct by certain individuals. So what both the society and the circuit court has argued in their briefs is that this wasn't really a stay order. This was akin to an injunction against those parties from participating in the arbitration. If that's what the circuit court had intended to do, the circuit court would have had to exercise its discretion on a motion which was not filed and determine whether the four-part Brodomat standards were satisfied, likelihood of success on the merits of their claim. The question is which claim, the insurance dispute or some other claim not present before the court, whether there's irreparable harm to society as a result of the failure to enter an injunction, whether it lacked an adequate remedy at law, and whether it was necessary to preserve the status quo. Those are the standards this court is well aware of concerning an injunction,
right.
None
so
of which were addressed in this case.
Yep. So let's say the court had done that. Let's say we agree with society and in fact this was a badly worded injunction against the parties. We'd be reviewing that for an abuse of discretion. Right? That's going to be significantly different from looking at a petition for supervisory writ, wouldn't it?
If you were evaluating the court's analysis under some set of standards, certainly circuit courts have broad equitable authority. Courts have discretion to exercise those equitable powers.
Yeah. So would there have been, and again, let's just assume for the sake of argument that the court had issued an injunction against the parties instead of a stay of proceedings, would there have been any irreparable harm?
Would there have been irreparable harm to CityDeck?
Correct.
I think there is irreparable harm, and again, something that was not considered by the circuit court in the context of evaluating the four-part injunction standard that was not addressed. The irreparable harm is that we continue to lose money that we will not recover because of the delay associated with our arbitration proceedings.
Is delay always an irreparable harm?
Not necessarily.
Is this delay different?
How is this delay different? The delay involves the inability on the part of the parties to the arbitration dispute to give effect to their contractual rights to proceed with arbitration. This is, as it relates to the standards for supervisory writ, one of the issues that has been raised by the respondents here is that there's no clear legal duty. Our position is, yes, there is, because the court has a legal duty to act within the scope of its jurisdiction. But
If we were to review this, I'm hearing abuse of discretion, but if the court didn't apply the correct legal standard in reaching its conclusion with respect to an injunction, would that be subject to an abuse of discretion standard?
It would be. And the question would be whether the court followed the appropriate standards that govern the exercise of that discretion, because in the absence of standards.
Right. So if the court didn't follow the law with respect to its application of, you know, its discretion, then you're saying we would review the legal standard applied for abuse of discretion? Like, close enough, you didn't use the right law, but you did so with your discretion?
No, if we were to evaluate this case based upon the hypothetical, now granted it's the argument that the respondents have made, but I think it's not the case that's presented here. If we assume that what the circuit court did was grant an injunction enjoining certain parties from participating in the arbitration.
What did we do with the fact that none of the findings required are there?
Then I think the analysis is that the circuit court abused its discretion in determining whether an injunction should issue because it failed to properly apply the standards that are well established in the case law for determining whether to issue an injunction.
And when we talk about irreparable harm, at least when I've been called upon as a trial judge to take a look at whether an injunction should issue, it's been in the context of evaluating those criteria with respect to the injunction issuing for the people requesting the injunction. Will they be irreparably harmed? Not whether or not other people might be irreparably harmed as a result of an injunction issued. The irreparable harm inquiry, at least as I understood it, was with respect to the person asking for the injunction.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that would be one of the four parts of the standard for a temporary injunction. The moving party must demonstrate that in the absence of the temporary injunction, it would sustain irreparable harm. And what has been raised in that regard, albeit again, we're talking about a procedure we disagree with, meaning we don't think this was an injunction. I can get to that in a moment, but there was no point at which society said they would sustain irreparable harm in the absence of a stay or an injunction, however we choose to describe it. And what they were concerned about was having to expend money. And that's what insurance companies are often required to do when there's a dispute about a coverage obligation. And there's a very fundamental point we've raised in our brief, but there isn't something different about this case simply because we're dealing with an insurance company. Society Insurance provided a policy of insurance to a building subcontractor. It should be on notice that disputes resolved in the context of construction matters are often, almost usually, resolved by arbitration. What society is saying in this case is we shouldn't be subject to the arbitration that our insured is subject to. They could have intervened in the arbitration itself and sought a stay and a resolution of the coverage dispute in front of the arbitrator, but it chose not to. It chose to go to court and ask the court in a declaratory judgment action to resolve that question.
Why would they want to intervene when they don't want to be part of it? I mean, it seems like that's a rather circuitous argument. Ever make a circuitous argument.
I would hope not, Your Honor.
You dastn't do that.
But they're the insurance company who has issued an insurance policy. They're not a third party walking in off the street, and they need to make a decision whether or not they want a resolution in the forum where their insured is now litigating, or to take some separate action, which they did, and they're entitled to, and they're entitled to ask the circuit court for a determination on whether they have an obligation to provide coverage for GB Builders and SMET. But by choosing that, they have foregone the opportunity to request for a stay within the context of the arbitration proceeding. That was their choice. They're a sophisticated insurance company who can make a determination about which choice to make. And as I said a moment ago, they issued an insurance policy, and I'm sure they're issuing many insurance policies to building contractors and some contractors, who are almost uniformly going to resolve their disputes in the context of arbitration. They should know that this is a situation they may have to deal with.
I want to go back to the questions asked by Justice Kelly and Justice Ziegler with respect to the injunction issue, because if we're talking about a situation where the court could have enjoined the parties in front of it from participating in the arbitration, and we agree that the court has that authority to do that. They didn't do that here in the formal way. What is the irreparable harm that your client's suffering, if we're just really talking about the method, if the court had the authority over the individuals in front of it? Do you see what I'm asking? I think irreparable harm is the crux of this entire, at least in my mind, this case. Whether the court did or didn't do it the way they should have, if they could have done it by enjoining those parties.
Well, I don't think they could have in this case. I think we're talking about the hypothetical that the circuit court has authority to issue injunctions. We would concede that. But in this case, there were indispensable parties that were not included in the circuit court proceeding. I think that alone is a defect that would prevent the circuit court from acting to enjoin certain parties to an arbitration, but not others. There were other parties not part of the circuit court.
Why couldn't the court enjoin the parties in front of it to not participate in the arbitration? And let's be clear, too. We're talking about a stay, right? We're talking about delay. And that's the other piece I want to ask you. How is delay? The case law I've read says delay is not irreparable harm. It's delay.
I think it's irreparable harm. The stay of the arbitration proceeding is irreparable harm insofar as it deprives us of the right to give effect to our arbitration agreement, our private right to participate in a dispute resolution process that does not involve the judiciary or does not involve the government.
Counsel, why are you telling us irreparable harm to your client? Wasn't it society who moved for the stay?
Right.
Society must show irreparable harm, not your client.
I thought I was answering Justice Kelly's question as it relates to the appropriateness of a supervisory writ. Certainly, if society had moved for a temporary injunction before the circuit court, it would have had to show that it would sustain irreparable injury in the absence of a temporary injunction. It didn't show that.
Okay, but what did society move for at the circuit court?
It moved for a stay of the arbitration.
Okay, fine.
And it didn't. I think language is very important, Your Honor. I'm sure we all agree about that. And they didn't. A court doesn't stay parties. A court enjoins parties. A court stays proceedings.
Right. Right.
And what the respondents have done here is trying to recharacterize the nature of the motion society filed and the order that the circuit court issued as one that is fundamentally unlike the actual action that the circuit court took. The circuit court called it a motion for a stay of the arbitration. It issued an order staying the arbitration. If it looks like a stay and it acts like a stay, it's probably a stay, especially when the circuit court calls it a stay.
Counsel, I'm hearkening back again to some of my trial judge days when people would come in and they try to get a judge to intervene, then me, in an arbitration proceeding and seek relief that wasn't called for under the statute. It's my recollection that a court's role when it comes to arbitration is exceedingly limited. Can you talk to me a little bit about what the statutes allow courts to do when it comes to issues that should be arbitrated?
I'd be happy to, and I think that's an excellent point, and it also goes to a question that Justice Kelly had asked before, which is, are there other reasons why a court should not involve itself in a matter like this, which involves a private, separate arbitration proceeding? The Wisconsin Arbitration Act contemplates that private parties may contract to resolve their disputes in a private arbitration proceeding without the involvement of the judiciary. And the Wisconsin Arbitration Act provides very limited roles for the judiciary with respect to arbitration agreements. The most fundamental one is that arbitration agreements are recognized as valid and enforceable, so that if a party refuses to arbitrate pursuant to the agreement that it signed, the other party can go to court and seek an order compelling arbitration. That's one of the specific things that a court can do in the context of an arbitration proceeding. There are, a few other actions the court can take, confirming an arbitration award, hearing motions that relate to the propriety of the award itself. But the Wisconsin Arbitration Act is limited, and it does not allow for court involvement and intervention in the arbitration proceeding itself, except to the extent specifically articulated in the Wisconsin Arbitration Act. As it relates to this case, it's not critical, but it's important to recognize that this case, this arbitration case, the one that's pending in front of the arbitrator involving the construction dispute, never had any contact with or involvement with a circuit court. There was never any dispute among the parties that there was an obligation to arbitrate pursuant to their contract. Nobody sought court involvement to compel arbitration or to take certain actions that may be appropriate for a circuit court to take in the context of that arbitration. It was entirely a private, separate proceeding like any other proceeding, to be quite honest with you, if we were having a settlement meeting or we're having some other discussion about resolving our dispute privately pursuant to some agreed-upon mechanism, the court has no greater authority to reach out and to get involved in this private arbitration proceeding than it would to get involved in some settlement discussion or other private conduct.
Counsel, what is it you want this court to do?
Very simply, Your Honor, and thank you for asking that question. We would ask for this court to direct the circuit court to vacate its stay order, thereby allowing the parties to proceed with the arbitration that had commenced well over a year prior to the stay order being entered. And the coverage issue that the circuit court has before it is, while it may be relevant to the question of whether there's insurance proceeds to pay for GB Builders, one of the subcontractors' work on this, it is not an issue that must be resolved in order for us to proceed, and it never has been an issue that needed to be resolved for us to proceed with the arbitration.
Counsel, but isn't the pot of money and how large it can be part of the very essence of the arbitration? Who's going to pay what?
Not specifically, Your Honor. The question of who's going to pay what is determined independent of where that money is going to come from.
And well, collectively, who's going to pay what?
You know, fair enough. And if the insurance coverage dispute took months and months to be decided after a final arbitration determination, and it was determined society had an obligation to provide coverage, the money would be there. And if the money was not there because it didn't have a coverage obligation, the obligation would be that of GB Builders, the subcontractor, and whether it's collectible or not is our problem. But it doesn't, the coverage question doesn't need to be resolved before we get to proceed with the merits of our.
One of the things that bothered me in this case is that the court issued a stay order that involved people or entities that were not before the court. But then I said to myself, well, in this kind of a situation, and it wasn't done here, I think that unlike the normal necessary party statute, the declaratory relief statute has a specific language regarding necessary party that's broader. And arguably, society could have named those other parties as necessary parties under the broader declaratory relief statute of 80604. Would that have taken care of the problem of not having the parties before the court?
If all parties to the arbitration were before the circuit court, it would remedy a problem, a hypothetical problem that doesn't exist, which is that the court could take action on an injunction motion which wasn't filed. So we've addressed those issues, Your Honor, in our brief simply because they underscore the problems with the circuit court's stay order, but it's fundamentally a stay order.
So, counsel, is your position that even if all the parties had been made, if the circuit court's authority had been extended to all parties to the arbitration, the court would still lack jurisdiction to issue a stay order?
That would be our position, Your Honor. The court lacked the authority as a legal matter, as a matter of the court's jurisdiction or its power, because it was addressing matters, it was taking action to address matters that were not before the court. The threshold question of whether the court has power is an important one, and this court has reminded in decisions that courts should confirm before taking action that they have the authority to act. There's also a separation of powers concern in this case, which is the nature of the action taken by the circuit court in this case was legislative or executive in nature. The power of the court to act is only triggered when a matter is brought before it. Legislatures can reach out and take actions that affect the rights and interests of parties merely by virtue of geography. Now, subject to the right to vote, which is, you know, the power of the people to determine who their legislators and who their executive is, those those branches of government have broad authority to take action regardless of whether there's been a dispute brought to them. The power of the judiciary is dependent upon a dispute being brought to the judiciary, to being brought before it. And what the circuit court did here in this case is exercise power that's more akin to legislative or executive power by treating this arbitration proceeding as some inferior tribunal over which it has presumptive jurisdiction. That's the essence of the problem with this case, is that the circuit court here had no greater right to interfere with or stay that private arbitration proceeding than it had to decide the issues that were pending in that arbitration proceeding. It would necessarily, you know, the court would necessarily have to have those kinds of powers for it to actually tell the arbitrator, stop, or I'm going to tell you what the rules are that you have to follow. It may not be as an extreme example as that, but staying the arbitration in and of itself is an extrajudicial act for which the court did not have power. It also abrogates the contract rights that the parties had, and I think that is what is also a fundamental problem with the circuit court's order here, is that private parties ought to be able to resolve their disputes through an agreed-upon process that does not require them to resort to the government, here the judicial branch, for a resolution. That's the private right of contract. They've chosen that method by which to resolve their disputes. And the circuit court has said, well, you can get to that at some point, but in the meantime, I'm going to put a stop to it. Whether that's a permanent stay against this arbitration proceeding or only a temporary one, the effect is the same. The court has said it has the right to interfere with our ability to proceed with that private dispute resolution process. And it's, again, an action clearly in excess of the court's power. I see my light has stopped, so I don't even see the need to make any concluding remarks. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Level. It's my honor to be representing Society Insurance in this matter before you today. I have an outline and some highlights of the briefing and argument I want to make to you today, but I want to maximize our time. So if you have questions for me, please pepper me with them. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I do.
You'll never find this court shy in that regard.
Excellent. I enjoy the back and forth.
All right, yes, so, Justice Kelly. Counsel, in your briefs to this court, you suggested that you had asked for an injunction against the party's participation in arbitration. Is that right?
I'm sorry, that...
Your briefs before this court suggested that the society had requested an injunction against the party's participation in the arbitration, as opposed to a stay of the arbitration proceedings.
I believe our motion was styled a motion for stay, and I think we've argued that that's what it was. I think we chose the title of it, frankly, because of Supreme Court precedent over a number of years suggesting a stay is what one calls it when one seeks to stop people from doing something related to an underlying action while you get the coverage resolved.
So you are a very experienced attorney, and you know that stays go against proceedings. Injunctions go against parties. We enjoin parties. We stay proceedings, right?
I think that's generally true as a matter of Hornbook law, yes.
Okay. And so what the circuit court did here was actually purport to stay proceedings.
I respectfully disagree a bit with you, and here's why. Our motion for the stay here sought for a stay among the parties, and that language was expressly used.
Counsel, let me quote some of your language from page 2 of your circuit court brief. Society requests in this lawsuit declaratory judgment on the scope of its insurance duties and hereby moves for a stay on the defendant's arbitration proceeding.
Yes, and that sentence was, we used the word defendants because those were all the parties that were before the circuit court.
Counsel, with respect, you were asking for a stay of the proceeding. You identified the proceeding you wanted stayed by reference to the defendants. But you were asking for a stay of the proceedings, and you repeated that on page 4 of your brief, where you said a stay on the arbitration proceedings is proper? and again on page 4 of your brief, given that liability in this matter is being determined in an arbitration proceeding, the most prudent course of action is to stay the arbitration proceeding. Yes?
Yes, it appears you're quoting, and I stand by what we wrote.
All right, so how are we to interpret this in any other way than that you were asking for a stay on proceedings, not to enjoin the parties?
Well, I'll draw a distinction, and maybe it's not significant. I suggest it is, that there were numerous other parties, Lunda, for example, that were involved in an arbitration. We had no issue with Lunda. There was no coverage claim from Lunda. There was a coverage claim from Smet and GB Builders. And so it's their participation in proceedings we were after. And to the extent the proceedings would have involved the three of them, yeah, that's what we wanted to stay.
Okay, so given what the court ordered, which was consonant with your motion, it was a stay of the proceedings, could the other parties to the proceeding, parties other than CityDeck and Smet, have proceeded with the arbitration?
To the extent they had separate arbitration proceedings pending, I think they could have. And
Just stop you right there. Let's just say it's all one proceeding. Yeah? CityDeck, Smet, Smet's subcontractors. One proceeding. The parties before the court were CityDeck and Smet, right?
GB Builders also.
GB Build. Okay. So, but not all the parties to the arbitration were before the court.
Assuming it's all one proceeding, correct?
Yeah. Okay. So the court staying the proceedings means that none of the parties to the arbitration proceeding could proceed, correct?
Under the assumption that it was all viewed as one proceeding, that would be correct.
Yeah.
I think it would be impractical for them to try to do otherwise.
Right. So is there any argument in the briefs or the record that there were separate arbitration proceedings involved?
I know we made reference to the fact that there was an arbitration proceeding involving Lunda. I know that...
Right, but in the CityDeck and Smet arbitration, you agree that there are five parties to that, right?
Five parties?
Five parties. CityDeck, Smet, and three of the Smet subcontractors.
Candidly, I don't know the precise number of who all was joined.
But isn't that important? Because if your position is that this is really just an injunction, then it depends on the court having jurisdiction over all the parties it was enjoining, right?
Well, if it's styled as an injunction, there are different standards applied. You heard them referencing in Grootemoot. And,
well, yeah, but we're just talking about jurisdiction right now, right? Over whom did the court have jurisdiction?
The parties that were before it in the action.
To be clear,
that was not all five parties.
In the record, there is the American Arbitration Association. There's the answer, and it does list CityDeck, Smet, Lunda, GB Builders, Security Lipke Roofing, and Lakeland Construction. So that's in the record that there are a number of parties. I was just trying to add that to your questioning.
So is it your position that the circuit court had personal jurisdiction over all the parties involved in the arbitration?
Using that list of the parties as the parties in the arbitration, no. I mean, we had personal jurisdiction over Smet, GB Builders, and
CityDeck,
thank you.
Right, so just those three?
Correct.
All right. So if we take the court at its word with what it did, it stayed the arbitration proceedings, and that involved parties that over which the circuit court did not have jurisdiction, right?
Taking that list of five, that part would be correct, but I submit that, you know, it's incumbent to view what the court did with recognition of the fact that it was attempting to apply its decision to the parties that were before it. I don't think the court ever intended to apply its decision to those who were not.
Counsel, how could the arbitration proceed with just the three subcontractors who were brought into it by the general contractor? What would that look like?
It would be impractical. I would
also. It would be impossible, wouldn't it? There's no one there to make the claim against them, to advance the claim against them. They would just sit there and say, what?
Well, at the time that the deck action was commenced and ultimately the circuit court entered the stay order here, some of those third parties had just been added. I mean, I think it was an early part of the proceeding where not much was going to happen practically anyway, I submit. But it's true. If you have a stay that applies to some but not all of parties in an arbitration, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to proceed.
And just to clarify the record, and I'm not going to read them all to you, but the court's order was very clear that it was staying the arbitration proceedings. It didn't couch it in terms of staying those proceedings only with respect to the parties before it, right?
I think there's language in the decision that's broadly phrased that way, yes.
Well, okay, then I am going to read it to you. It is hereby ordered that society's motion to stay the arbitration proceedings is granted.
Right.
So that you do concede that stopped the arbitration proceedings.
Yes.
Thank you.
Can I add a caveat?
Sure.
The circuit court recognized, and the parties advised the court, that there was a mediation pending in that arbitration. And, in fact, the circuit court ordered us to appear at that mediation. And we would have done so, obviously. And had the parties wanted to proceed with that arbitration, I submit they would have done that mediation. But CityDeck backed out of it, and that's of record in this case.
So other than the mediation, the court stopped the arbitration proceeding.
That seems to be the effect of the practical effect of the language in the decision, yes.
To what import should we give the fact that arbitration is something that people can contract into doing so that in no small measure they avoid all the expense, time, things associated with litigation, the formality of litigation, and then when all it would take would be one party's insurer to say, wait a minute, we first want a determination of whether we have to cover or defend, to stop all that. I mean, doesn't that undermine the entire purpose of people being able to proceed to arbitration? I mean, it really puts arbitration on a back burner and litigation on the front burner despite the party's wishes, doesn't it?
That's one way of viewing it. I would suggest another view for you, respectfully, Justice, and Justice Ziegler. And that is that I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I've read lots of decisions that have said arbitration is less expensive, it's faster, and I'm here to tell you that isn't true anymore. Arbitrations in the construction litigation business are extremely expensive. They're lengthy. They're not a whole lot different than what happens in the circuit court.
That may or may not be true, but the record here wouldn't contain that, right?
True. There's not a factual development about that being true. But I'm just suggesting that the underlying assumption that somehow arbitration is a panacea just doesn't hold true anymore in the everyday practice of construction dispute resolution.
Counselor, but it doesn't really matter, does it? Because parties have a right to contract for arbitration if they choose. No one can force it on them, but they are free to contract for it, correct?
Absolutely, without doubt. But the parties are also free not to make a claim for insurance coverage. And so CityDeck could have come forward and said, we're not after society's policy. And then we wouldn't have this dispute. Society wouldn't have a need to join them under Baston as an interested party.
That would get a lot of cases off our docket. You'd be surprised how many insurance claims.
You know, yeah. I understand the logic behind bifurcation of proceedings. You know, if this were just a lawsuit in court, no arbitration involved, and you wanted a determination on coverage or duty to defend, sometimes those things can be bifurcated. There have been other cases that I had, though, where it essentially would result in a trial where someone's alleging intentional conduct versus negligent conduct. So you might as well have the trial because you're going to have a trial to determine coverage and a trial on the same thing, essentially, to determine liability. So sometimes it can't be bifurcated. Why is this one of those situations where it ought to be essentially bifurcated and your determination take precedence over the arbitration proceeding?
I can answer that, and I'd like to make a comment about it before I answer it, if I could.
Yeah.
And I think the Justice's question points out that what's before us really is a discretionary decision by the Circuit Court, not a clear legal right that was violated, because in some instances, a coverage trial might very well be duplicative of a merits trial, and it would make no sense to order that. But in many other instances, they're not duplicative, and it does make sense for reasons this court has cited in the past, that insurance companies should not have to endure expense all the way to verdict in a case where they have no coverage. And so I submit to you the circuit court should weigh a number of factors. And one of them is, how quickly is the insurance company moving? We had our summary judgment motion for coverage filed before the decision for stay was ever entered. We moved as rapidly as we could. And so in those circumstances, I submit to you, the sort of bifurcation of you, as you've referenced it, makes sense, because in the weighing of the interests, the insurance company is showing it wants to get to the end as quickly as possible. It's not delaying it. And that's all that was proposed here, and I think Justice Dallet raised a question about that. It was not a delay is not irreparable harm here, and we moved as rapidly as humanly possible.
Yeah, but they don't have the burden to show irreparable harm. It really troubles me when that keeps popping into this argument. That's a standard for someone asking for an injunction. But if it were an injunction that you requested rather than a stay, it would be society's burden. It would not be opposing counsel and parties' burdens, correct?
I should clarify.
We got some confusion.
What I meant, and what Mr. Lavelle was correct in what I was asking, and we can use the word hardship, because that's what, it's the issue of whether the supervisory writ is the appropriate mechanism or not.
Grave hardship.
Yes. So yes. I'm sorry for saying irreparable harm when I meant grave hardship. They are similar, but it is true that that is the crux of what the question was that I had asked before.
Thank you. That helps to clarify it for me, because I don't want us to get off track.
Right.
And then I think Justice Abramson asked, what do you really want? And what is requested here is simply to vacate the stay. That's what was requested here. So if this court were to determine the state stay was not properly issued, then all we'd have to do is vacate the stay, and that's simply reversal of what occurred before. I think that's what counsel said. So I'm not sure that this case is about any kind of a writ from the way it's being argued here.
Why couldn't your case proceed alongside of the arbitration? Why couldn't your coverage issues be essentially tried separately and distinctly from the arbitration proceeding?
It certainly could, and the court, the justice undoubtedly recalls, I asked the court, this court, to lift the stay on the circuit court so the circuit court could proceed to answer those summary judgment questions we had put to it so we could all get to our endpoint quicker. The problem with lifting the stay and now proceeding to summary judgment is if the arbitration proceeds at 100 miles an hour, society is incurring the expense of defending GB Builders in a case it should not have to defend. And
well, that's a different issue.
I'm sorry?
That's a different issue, isn't it? You're saying they shouldn't have to defend, but that's all based on the contract.
The policy. By
yes.
Contract, you mean the policy?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, our position at the circuit court is that this policy does not apply. Out of an abundance of caution, and as suggested by this court in many decisions, we have under reservation of rights hired defense counsel for GE Builders.
I heard a lot of argument about the delay and whether that was an appropriate consideration. It kind of assumes that the court had the power to take account of those issues and do what it did. But I go to Chapter 788, which governs arbitration. I don't see anything in Chapter 788 that gave the court the power to stay the arbitration proceeding. What I do see is 788.02, stay of action to permit arbitration. So that empowers a court with a case before it to stay that case when there's a contract providing for arbitration. But I don't see any provision in the reverse. Is there any provision in Chapter 788 on which society is relying to support its position in this case?
No, and I would point out that there's nothing in 788 that says the stay couldn't have been granted either. 788 is silent on the very issue that's before us, nor does it say 788 preempts the entire field. And in that vein, I'd like to point out that there's a whole body of common law developed by the court about what's procedurally arbitrable versus what's substantively arbitrable. And that distinction is nowhere in Chapter 788 either.
Counsel, we are here with regard to a analytical template for a writ, a supervisory writ. And so much of the discussion today has dealt with the first element of that template, that is plain duty. Some reference was just made to the second element, grave hardship. And would you address the second element that's required to be proven in order to be entitled to a supervisory writ?
Yes, and the extraordinary hardship, I wrote it down in my outline as extraordinary hardship. I submit that's what the court said in both Buchanan and Kalal, and it's the petitioner's burden here to show it, and we submit that that has not been shown at all. In fact, just the opposite. The delay that was complained of by CityDeck is belied by its conduct in the pursuit of this appeal. We suggested to CityDeck, for example, that it withdraw the petition and that it allow the summary judgment decision to occur so that that would be concluded and the arbitration could be back on track.
Speaking now to the third element, prompt and speedy request for relief, or are you not speaking to that?
No, I'm still speaking to extraordinary hardship in the sense that if they had an extraordinary hardship, wouldn't their conduct have been different? Wouldn't they have attended a mediation? Wouldn't they have withdrawn this so that the summary judgment could be done?
Counsel, first matter, don't we have to determine whether the court could issue this stay? Because if we simply reverse the court and say it had not the authority to issue the stay that it did, then I don't think we even get to the writ proceedings, do we? I mean, there's no stay then.
That's the first element of the burden on a petition for supervisory writ, is to show the violation of a clear legal duty, and that's
No, that's not what I'm saying to you. A clear legal duty is different than whether the court erred as a matter of law at the circuit court by making a decision that it didn't have a legal foundation to make. That's different.
I understand it to be the petitioner's argument that that is the violation of the clear legal duty.
It may be his argument. That isn't my question.
Okay?
My question is, if this court were to determine that the circuit court did not have the power to issue the stay that it issued and to vacate that stay, isn't that the end of this case?
Probably.
Let me ask.
But
go ahead.
If I could follow up on that.
Sure, of course.
As argued in our brief, under 806.04, the statute clearly gives the circuit court power to construe agreements and provide for the rights and state the duties of the parties to the agreement. And it has broad authority to do that. And that broad authority underlie its decision to issue the stay here. So,
But if we disagree that the court either had or properly exercised the broad authority you asked it to exercise in your declaratory judgment action, then that's the end of it. There isn't anything else to deal with, correct?
Right. I think that would be adopting the petitioner's position that there was a violation of a clear duty because
they couldn't
act outside.
I think that there are different tests for a writ, but that's just me. But I do understand, and I thank you for the answer.
I see my red lights on.
Yep.
I'd love to continue.
Counsel, after you get your name out,
I'm talking about the new counsel here. I want to follow up on the questions just asked.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Brian Keenan on behalf of the Circuit Court for Brown County, Honorable Thomas Walsh.
Thank you. My understanding of the law is that in order to be entitled to a supervisory writ, three elements have to be proven, and all three elements have to be shown. And if one of the three is not shown, then you don't get your writ. Am I incorrect or correct in that assessment?
No, you are correct. We believe that the petitioners they've brought a petition for supervisory writ and therefore need to show the elements of a supervisory writ, one of which is the violation of a plain legal duty. I think a lot of this conversation comes about because there is another avenue for obtaining intermediate appellate relief, which would be an appeal by permission, which they did not seek for whatever reason. But to get a supervisory writ, you need to meet the criteria of the supervisory writ, which is a plain legal duty. And so should the court find there was a violation of a plain legal duty, then it could issue the writ. the court could find, for example, that the order is improper or think the order is improper and yet still find there's not a supervisory writ is appropriate because perhaps there's no grave hardship or perhaps it's a legal error but just isn't a plain legal duty. For example, an erroneous exercise of discretion would be a mistake of law, perhaps, but it would not be appropriate for a supervisory writ, while it could be perhaps be appropriate for appeal by permission.
So what you're saying is that we can't interpret the arguments made before us without finding a plain legal duty that the circuit court violated because of the procedural posture that this court is in, given the choices that were made.
Correct. And it's the petitioner's decision to proceed through this appellate mechanism, so they have to meet the criteria for that mechanism. Frankly, we believe that the permission by appeal by permission would have been a more appropriate route here, but they filed their petition too late to do that, so it's really not available for this court to enter that type of relief.
Okay. Thank you very much. That helps me a lot.
And from the circuit court's perspective, the issue here is really the plain legal duty. They're supposed to be clear and unequivocal and non-discretionary. And
are the cases, in your opinion, consistent on this? Because I can tell you that I went through cases to find plain legal duty and to see what it meant, and I did not find the cases consistent. I found that they would say that there's a plain legal duty. There were lines of cases that said that, and I agreed with that. I mean, that was clear. But then there'd be case law that was all over the map as to what people had to do and what their obligations under the law were. And some cases said plain legal duty. Other cases said heck no.
Well, we believe that the most recent cases of this court, and there's been a few in the past few years, have used the term plain legal duty, or a duty that is plain and non-discretionary. So we think that is the standard. There may be some discrepancies in how you apply that standard to certain factual situations or procedural
posture. Is a discretionary duty a plain legal duty?
No, that is clear it's not. That like an abuse of discretion would not qualify for a supervisory writ. And the type of duties that have been found, you know, to support a supervisory writ have been things like the proper appellate venue for an appeal, which was a case just recently before this court, a judge's failure to substitute himself when it was required by law, perhaps like the violation of attorney-client privilege, and things like that. We haven't found a case that's similar to this, which involves, you know, a novel question of law that, you know, kind of involves like whether the circuit court's equitable power would extend to this type of action or whether it's sort of preempted by the Wisconsin Arbitration Act.
Counsel, we've never held that novelty of law precludes a finding of a clear legal obligation, correct?
That's correct, and that's true. And there could be a plain legal duty based on comparing various statutes together, like in the appellate venue decision from earlier this year or last year, I believe.
Would it not be fair to say that a circuit court has a plain legal duty to not exercise jurisdiction over proceedings over which it does not have jurisdiction?
Okay. Yes, I think there would be a plain legal duty not to act outside its jurisdiction. We believe the court didn't act outside its jurisdiction in this case in the sense that it had jurisdiction over the case.
Where
and
would
it was issued relief in support of being able to decide that case.
Well, let's poke at that just a little bit. So it had jurisdiction over the parties before it, correct?
Correct.
Did it have jurisdiction over the arbitration proceedings?
It did not have jurisdiction over the arbitration proceedings and over several parties to the arbitration.
So it had no jurisdiction to stay the proceedings, the arbitration proceedings, then, correct?
I think it had no jurisdiction to stay the parties that weren't before it.
So hang on a second. So we've got two different issues. Injunctions against parties, enjoining parties, right, on the one hand, and staying proceedings on the other. Those are two different things, right?
Correct.
Okay. Did the circuit court have jurisdiction to stay the arbitration proceedings?
I would say it did not have jurisdiction to stay everyone in the entire arbitration proceedings.
No, 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 no. Not people, the proceedings. Did it have jurisdiction to stay the proceedings?
It is not governing the arbitration, so it doesn't have the authority to stay the arbitration entirely. It does have the ability to issue relief as to parties before it. And so to the extent the court is concerned that it overstepped its bounds, we've offered the alternative that if the circuit court could do what it did, but with just different words or using a different legal analysis, then you're not violating a plain legal duty if this court would vacate the order, but then the court could do the exact same thing.
Well, counsel,
just using different terms.
We have to pay attention to what the circuit court actually did, don't we?
Exactly. True.
Right.
But
so
I think
we can't go back and change history and say, well, you know, you could have done something analogous to this by entering an injunction against the parties instead of staying the proceedings, and so we're going to pretend like you did something you didn't do. That wouldn't be proper for us to do, would it?
Well, I think it would be in the sense that if the court simply just vacates the order and then Society Insurance now moves for a temporary injunction, I think the circuit court would like to know, well, does it have the authority to do that or not? So we're not back up here again a year from now.
But what the circuit court could have done is have a coverage trial.
Well, it was doing that. It was having a summary judgment proceedings, and it's been stayed for months now.
Yeah, but it stayed the arbitration. My guess is the insurance company didn't want to do both, right? They didn't want to defend at the arbitration and spend resources and time in the arbitration and at the same time spend resources and time trying a coverage case.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, or the circuit court could have stayed the coverage dispute and waited for the determination in the arbitration. It wasn't that the circuit court couldn't act at all with respect to this. It's just whether it could act in the way it did.
Yes, and
here.
Correct. And we haven't claimed any different. The circuit court, though, was moving quickly on deciding the coverage issue so that it wouldn't delay things, but it was stopped by that because this court entered a stay of the lower court proceedings, and so it hasn't been able to issue a decision on the coverage summary judgment motion. But it was moving, it intends to move quickly to decide that issue, but it just hasn't been able to for the last several months.
So, I mean, the authority of the court with respect to the parties, it's not that the court had zero authority to act in any possible way, but the issue is whether the court had the authority to one of the issues is whether the court had the authority to issue the stay of the arbitration proceeding in favor of determining essentially the coverage dispute before it.
Yes.
Could it stop that while it decided this other? Now, if those were both in circuit court, there's certainly authority for that. But where's the authority when you don't have the typical situation where coverage and liability are both before the circuit court and the circuit court bifurcates that determination? Because essentially the court bifurcated the liability determination, the arbitration and damages determination, the arbitration, in favor of saying my coverage issue is going to take precedence here over your right to contract and have a separate tribunal decide these issues.
Yes, I think the issue in this case is whether there is a need for a specific statute to authorize that or whether that would be allowed under the court's general equitable authority and would only be prohibited if there was a statute specifically taking away that power.
Can you think of another scenario where the court can decide to stay another, essentially, court from acting when it's on equal footing? Can you think of, I mean, could we tell the Seventh Circuit, you know what, hands off, we're just going to take this and decide it?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. Can you think of any other setting where you've got two tribunals and one gets to tell the other one, hey, I'm going to decide that you can't decide?
I see my red light's on, but if I could just...
You can answer the question.
The question. I believe there are cases where there's two trial courts determining the same case where there's... under the ability of one court to prevent the party from litigating in the other court.
Thank you. Counsel, I want you to assume that there has been
a violation of a plain legal duty. And I want you to go to the second prong that you must show for entitlement to a supervisory writ. I look at the Keekhafer case that says where the petition fails to allege any facts which disclose that he would suffer great hardship, the writ may not be granted. So give me your argument about the great hardship you have sustained.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd be happy to. There are a number of issues here. One is that we're prevented from proceeding with the resolution of our dispute, which in and of itself constitutes substantial hardship. But the delay associated with our inability to resolve that dispute has real and practical consequences for our client, which is we have a building with substantial defects that need to be remedied, for which there needs to be a determination as to responsibility. And every day that that is delayed is a day that the residents within our building have a building that is not completely repaired. Our client is forced to go and get additional financing to pay for repairs that can be taken care of, which are costs that are not recoverable from society insurance for the delay that's caused here.
Counsel, what you're responding to, it makes some sense. Your response, rather, certainly makes sense. I don't have before me. Did you allege this kind of grave hardship, or does the record reflect this kind of grave hardship that you endured?
Certainly the record before the circuit court would relate to those issues, that we were objecting to the stay because of our need to proceed with the arbitration and get a resolution to the underlying construction dispute. I'd ask the court, though, while I believe we've articulated the grounds for supervisory writ under the three standards that have been discussed here, I think there's a more fundamental issue, and it goes to the issue that Chief Justice Rogensack has referenced, which is if, in fact, this action taken by the circuit court finds no basis in law, it exceeds the court's jurisdiction by virtue of that fact, this court should act and exercise its supervisory
Aren't
jurisdiction.
Aren't you stuck with the vehicle you drove here? And that's the writ in the framework? Or should we change that vehicle right now?
Well, I don't think you need to change the vehicle. And the point that I was going to make a moment ago, we're not stepping away from the writ here, Your Honor. But the Beaudry case, which we cited in our brief, says that it's appropriate for the court to exercise its supervisory jurisdiction, quote, to prohibit inferior courts from acting outside their jurisdiction, unquote. That's precisely the reason why we chose the vehicle that we did, which is this otherwise would be a request for a permissive appeal of a non-final order. That's what the Court of Appeals treated it as when we asked the Court of Appeals to exercise its supervisory jurisdiction. But if that's the vehicle that we had ridden here, and it had been denied, our request for a permissive appeal had been denied, this very important and fundamental question about the scope of the circuit court's jurisdiction would evade review, because to address opposing counsel's suggestion that we should have withdrawn this appeal or this petition for supervisory writ because we would have gotten all that done sooner, maybe makes some practical sense. But it would mean that the issue we presented would evade review, because who would ever wait months and months to get a decision from this court when maybe the circuit court would have decided the issue and lifted the stay already? I'll tell you the practical reason why we are here today. Why am I here?
Yeah.
To quote Admiral Stockdale. Because
wherever
there is,
you go, there you are. That's
because there is no certainty that would be the end of the question. Either party in the coverage dispute could file an appeal as of right, and we could be stuck with a stay of our arbitration proceeding for an indefinite period of time. It's critical that this court answer this particular question, both to vacate the stay that's been issued in this case, but in order to send a clear message that circuit courts lack the authority to interfere in this manner with pending arbitration proceedings.
Right.
So I hear you making an argument with respect to delay that goes beyond your case in and of itself, that affects future cases in terms of the court's authority over arbitration disputes.
I think that's correct,
okay.
Your Honor. And one point I do want to make quickly before my red light goes on, but there was, I believe it was Justice Bradley talking about the scope of a court's authority under the Wisconsin Arbitration Act. And there's a line of cases from this court that applies the time-honored maxim of expressio unis exclusio alterius. And I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, but I'm sure the court is familiar with that maxim or that doctrine. And my red light is...
You may finish your thought.
Very briefly, but in the Leavitt decision from this court in 2010, there was a discussion of past decisions from this court that had applied that maxim to say if the Wisconsin Arbitration Act doesn't specifically authorize it, then it is excluded, that it's not allowed, and it's not the court, circuit court does not have that authority.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you both for very spirited arguments. As you can see, our bench is never shy about asking questions. The briefs were excellent, so we have enjoyed them a lot. We're going to take a brief recess so that we can get changed around for our next case. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.